Hello, my name is David Lankus. I'm a professor from Syracuse University, and I'm very pleased to speak to you today. I wish I could have done this live, but unfortunately, I'm in the middle of some medical issues that prevent me from knowing exactly what I'll be doing from day to day. So I really appreciate you putting up with the recording and spending some time with me. What I want to talk about today is the idea of libraries as community. Libraries are in a really interesting position. Some would say an endangered position. The idea of what do libraries look like in a Google era? What do libraries look like with all this digital information? What do libraries look like when people can go directly to the information source? Do we need librarians at all? My answer is yes, we need them more than ever, but not necessarily for the same reason that many people look at it. One of my sort of least favorite phrases is that librarians are the world's greatest search engines, that we can find things that others can't. I think that's a really bad place for librarians to be because when you compare us to Google, we don't come out very well. I don't mean that we can't find the right stuff and that we don't find what's accurate. I mean that we can't provide 30,000 million results in 10 milliseconds. I'm not quite sure that's the metric we want to come up with. But it's more than that. It's more than the idea that as librarians move into the future, move into a digital era, move into an environment where we're serving people that have cell phones and not necessarily running water, that somehow we need to be search engines. We need to be what we've always been over our couple thousand years of tradition, which are people that facilitate knowledge creation, that help people learn. That in essence, the core of what a library is a promise. It's an opportunity. It's not an opportunity to get at stuff and to check things out and to move things around and to find books or materials or search a database. It's not a community licensing agreement. It's a promise, an aspiration that people can come in and create new knowledge. That people can live out their dreams. That people can find out what it takes to become a doctor or a lawyer, to grow better crops, what have you. It's that promise that I think sits at the core of libraries and has for thousands of years. And so when you look and revisit that core, a lot of the current anxiety about what we do and how we do it is understandable, but there become some really interesting and clear ways that we can move forward. That's what I want to talk about today. And I'm going to start in an interesting place. I'm going to start at Galisano's Children's Hospital. That's what this is a picture of. They call it the Treehouse, and it is a children's hospital dedicated to medicine, oncology, etc., around children's issues. And they wanted to build a place that was attractive and specifically kid-friendly. And so they have these sort of really interesting lights. There's an ice cream place in there. There are places to work. Every room has a PlayStation so they can play. And within this facility is something called the Family Resource Center, which is the library. And it's a very interesting place because people can go there and the kids that are in there or the parents can go with them or even doctors can go with the children into this place and they can get games and books and materials. In fact, they're co-shelving things so that when you hear things like, well, your child has a brain tumor, there is a book that talks about the anatomy for the adults and there is a book that explains the anatomy for kids side by side. And within that is a brilliant librarian, Mary Laverty. And Mary has a very interesting position because not only does she sort of maintain the library, in fact, she just hired another librarian to handle that because most of what she spends her time doing is working directly with the doctors, working directly with the patients, working with family and children specialists. In essence, what she does is spends a lot of time doing this. She spends a lot of time going around and she actually serves on rounds. So rounds, for those of you who don't know, what happens is when you're in the hospital, the doctors form a team, usually several doctors and some of their students, for example, and they go from patient to patient, looking at the case, talking to the patients, getting and determining next acts, next steps. And Mary goes with them on the rounds. And some of the things that Mary does is, for example, when a child is diagnosed and the child hears that they have a given disease and that this disease is going to have a certain treatment, she's busy writing down sort of all the terms and phrases that the doctor uses. And when the doctor and the team leave that patient, she goes back and she grabs her iPad that has a unique IP address, so it's not identified as hospital, and she does a Google search on all those terms. And she spends time with the first 10 results determining which are the best results, which are credible, which are non-credible, and then she goes and sits with the child and with his parents and goes through those results because she knows that's what the parents are going to do as their first thing. So what she's doing is she's providing direct in-context services and she's bringing resources and materials. And it's come to the point where doctors will actually stop into the family resource center and say, "Hey, I'm about to give bad news to patient five. Can you make sure that you have these types of materials and information available, ready for the patient, ready for their parents?" In essence, the doctors are giving library prescriptions. And this is an amazing act because for me, it demonstrates the power of librarianship. It's also a fundamental change in what the Family Resource Center did. It used to be a place where kids could come in and find materials and books and recreational reading and such, and they sort of waited for people to come in. Mary's idea is the exact opposite, which is the power of the libraries to go out, to be in the rooms, to be in the houses, to be online, to be available to these patients full time, to work directly with the doctors, to work directly with teachers and people doing tutoring because the kids are out of school. That is the idea of a library being proactive and in and of the community. But I want to talk now a little bit about someone else in this picture, and it's not Mary. I actually want to talk about what's going on with the doctor, because the doctor's actually having some changes as well. The doctor in this model has a different role to play. The old model of medicine, the old model of what a doctor did was you had a sort of person in front of you, but really they were just a bag of symptoms. And so the doctor would ask questions and poke at you and prod at you and run tests, tell you what's wrong with you, give you a prescription, and send you on your way. And this idea was that the doctor knew it all and that the patient was relatively passive in this process. As long as the patient sat there and took the medicine, everything was fine. But something's changing in medicine. In medicine, they're realizing that this is not necessarily have the best outcome. That if you treat the patient simply as the user of a doctor, or simply as a consumer, or simply as someone who's passive, you actually have worse outcomes than if you include the patient in what they call patient-centered care. If you include the patient in their medical decision-making, the medical process, if you, in essence, educate the patient about their condition, about health, about wellness, about what they're doing, if you include them in the medical process, they have better outcomes. The idea being that I can sit and say, "You have diabetes, that you should have less sugar." But if I don't sort of educate them as to what diabetes is and how sugar can hurt them and how that can turn into this and that can turn into that, the patient doesn't truly understand the consequences and they may not follow a regime and they may lead to bad outcomes. And so what doctors have realized is they are much less the expert who simply knows everything and delivers information to this bag of symptoms, but the doctor is a facilitator of knowledge. They're a teacher. And not just a teacher of other doctors, they're a teacher of the patient. And that patient is not simply passive, but that patient must be active. Now, we see this in some extremes. For example, we see this right now going on in this rather big, interesting technology boom that's occurring. Though what you see here is a picture of just about every medical, what's called a fitness device. I actually have one in front of me, the Fitbit Force. And what this thing does is it tells me my steps. It tells me how many steps I've taken, how many calories I've burned, how many stairs I've gone up. Some of these will tell you about your heart rate and rhythm. Some of these will tell you about everything from blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting is the main consumers of this are not sick people. They're what are called the worried well. They're actually healthy people who want to remain healthy. They want to get healthier. They're joggers. They're people who exercise on a regular basis, monitoring what they're doing. But what we're seeing is this sort of active participation, this idea of sort of self-personalized medicine, where the patient is tracking their own characteristics, their own health, their own heartbeat, their own metrics, is changing that patient-centered care management as well. So we can take something, for example, like the medical health record. So the medical health record used to be where the doctor owned this record and they would write, "This person came in, they complained of this, I diagnosed this, I gave this test, here are the results," etc. So it used to be all about the doctor sort of doing their work and documenting their work. But things have become interesting when they move these records online. Not only do they realize that they can include other direct information. So you can say not only did I send them for a CAT scan, but you can see the CAT scan and directly manipulate it. But we now have the ability, for example, to directly enter other information in other people. So take, for example, all those wonderful medical health bits I talked about before. So the patient's walking around. The patient is showing you how active they are, when they walked, how far they walked, etc. They're showing you possibly blood pressure. They're showing you all this information. This information that may be stored by the patient can also become a direct part of this record. Imagine, if you will, that you call up your doctor and said, "You know, I have chest pains the other day." And the doctor can go in and through these devices find out, well, yes, you did. Your pulse went up high. Your blood pressure increased at this. We need to come in and take a look at this. And so we're seeing this idea of the medical health record not being simply an item of the doctor, but an item that's shared between the patient and the doctor, and all these metrics and information are going in. And so we can also then talk about this idea of a sort of library prescription, where this medical health record now becomes sort of a workflow, where the doctors can look at it, but the patients can look at it. And not only are we adding sort of doctor reviews and medical testing, but we begin adding information. So when the doctor says, you know, you have diabetes, you should go read this information, you should look at this, you should look at this document. The librarian has recommended these five resources for you to look at. That information can be included in there as well. So I'm going through some medical treatment right now for cancer, and what's interesting is when they check me in and they walk you through, do you smoke, do you drink, whatever. One of the questions that my hospital asks is, how do you best learn? Through dialogue, through demonstration, through visuals, through audio, how do you learn? They're including learning styles in my medical health record, not simply because it's some sort of interesting other medical bit, but because they know that part of their job is not simply to treat me, but to deal with the consequences of a treatment, to deal with the consequences of a diagnosis. And so when I go through chemo, they hand me these wonderful information sheets that tell me what chemicals they're putting in my body, which is kind of frightening when you realize that half of them are derived from mustard gas, but that's another issue. The idea is that they give you this information, and my nurses have said, well, this is the information we give to most people, but because you're a professor and you keep asking all these questions, here's the more in-depth information from Medline. Then that goes in the medical health record that David requires this additional information or this type of information, this kind of tutoring. And we know that there's all this other information that we can include, not only metrics, we can include not only documents, but we can include things like patient reactions. So this is a site called Care Pages, and there's another one called Caring Bridge and such, where patients are encouraged to journal and blog and talk about their treatments and talk about their feelings and talk about their symptoms and talk about their interactions. Because doctors and clinical physicians and psychologists and all these realize that the patient's attitude is almost as important as the treatment they receive. And they can monitor the attitude by what these patients are putting online. They can monitor how they're feeling and talk about depression and talk about these things. That becomes a medical health record. Now we can use this record not only for sort of getting this information together, to gather it and see and get a true perspective of what the patient's life is like and let the patient participate. But this is, for example, a medical device that's implanted within the body and can deliver medicine on demand. So quite literally, you can call up your doctor and say, I'm feeling chest pains. The doctor can reach out to all these medical devices sitting on your body and say, yes, you are, and order over the phone this device installed in you to deliver medication to bring your heartbeat down, to bring your pulse down. Full circle. The implications of this sort of new community perspective on medicine. We talk about patient-centered, but truly it's a community perspective where the doctor's part of that community, the patient's part of that community, the nurses are part of that community, caregivers, wives, and children are part of that community, is a shift in role and expertise. Doctors are struggling currently to deal with this idea that they used to be the holders of knowledge, that when you went to the doctor because they were right and they knew it all. And now their role is much more as an expert. They still know a lot. They still have the experience. They still have the medical knowledge, but they're also facilitating knowledge creation. They're also bringing the patient up to speed. So I have a rather grim example. Well, it's not grim, it was for me. So I'm going through chemotherapy, and one of the things they do with chemotherapy is they give you this shot called Neulasta. And what happens is the chemo makes that your white blood cells, makes your immune system go down, and the shot makes it go up. But one of the consequences, the way it does it, is it tells your bone marrow to really get busy producing white blood cells, which makes your bones really ache and it hurts. So a side effect of it is joint pain. And so I was going in going, oh, my jaw is killing me. This is really hurting. And they said, oh yeah, well, take this medicine, pain. It's the Neulasta. We know that's what it does. And I kept going, ah, this is hurting. And I could push down on a specific tooth and it would hurt. And I said, that's probably not right. So I went to see my dentist, and my dentist, like, literally reached into my mouth with a gloved hand, put it in a spot. I went, ow. He went, oh, yeah. took an x-ray and said, you have a root canal that's gone bad. You have to have that tooth out. It must be killing you. And sure enough, the next day, they pulled the tooth out. I felt so much better. Now, the reason I bring that up is this idea that a doctor, you go to an oncologist looks at you and says, oh, it's an oncology problem. And they answer, but this is the pain. You go to a dentist, they say, it's a dental problem. They hand this to you. You go to a neurologist, it's a neurology problem. What's happening is that doctors are realizing they can't know it all, and they have to work in a team as well. That the oncologist has to talk to the dentist, has to talk to the neurologist, has to talk to your primary care physician, that they work in a team, and I, as the patient, may know better than even the doctor. Right? I know what the pain is, and I can describe it, but really, I'm the one who ultimately said, I got to go see a dentist. And that becomes part of it. So expertise comes not from the individual. The doctor isn't the only expert in this equation. It comes from the community. It comes from all the doctors and the patients and my wife, who knows when I get that certain look in my eye, it's time for the medication, etc. That this medical care to reach to the best outcome, to truly develop the best knowledge to lead to the best outcome, is a community activity. We also see a shift in the role of documentation, where the documents, the medical health record, used to be a container that was authored and consumed. The doctor put information in it, the nurses would read out of it. And then we let the patients eventually see parts of it, but not too soon because they might actually search the internet and destroy what we're trying to do. But now that document becomes a workflow. It documents not only what the doctor sees and hears and feels, but the nurses and the patients, and everyone comes in and becomes part of that workflow document. And by doing so, we're learning together, we're treating together, we ultimately have a better outcome because we're all in this together. Now, you can sort of see where this is going, right? Because we can talk about librarians, and that librarians used to be the people who knew it all or knew how to find it all, and that people would come to them and we would turn around and do all our searches on fancy things like, you know, Elsevier and databases, and we would use Boolean logic, which is not spoken by mere mortals and such, and we would then give the information out. We're seeing now that people are coming to us with search results asking us to help sort through them. Right? The most insulting question you can ask half of the people in America is, oh, well, have you tried Google? Like, duh. If I didn't try Google, I wouldn't be here. Right? So we're seeing this shift as well. We see this shift in documents, where we used the idea that we would buy journals. And journals were the documents of scientific advancement. That when you read an article, that article not only documented a research study, it was the evidence of the research study. We're seeing now in the physics community and in just about every scholarly community that the time they write a journal article is the end. It's an archiving process. The true conversation, discussion, testing, trying it out happened online, happened through communities working together, and by the time they write the article, work's already done. So we're seeing this idea of documents change, and what is a document, what is the role of document. We're seeing the experts change. We see this not only in medicine, we see this in higher education. In higher education, the idea that the professor used to be a lecturer, that image there of someone standing before 200 hungry minds and delivering them brilliance, is an outdated model. It still happens. I have to tell you, I still do it. I mean, to a degree, that's what's happening here, and I apologize. But this idea that this is how we learn is being flipped on its head. In fact, we see that people try and take this model of how it happened to 300 undergraduates learning about physics, and we see people trying to put it online, and they do it through MOOCs, massive open online courses. The idea that we have 10,000, 30,000 people taking a course, because the truth is, when you have someone who's just the smart guy rambling on for an hour, who cares how big the audience is? We see that that direct translation isn't working the way people thought it was. The successful completion rate in these MOOCs is somewhere around 10% or less. That is, of the 30,000 people that sign up, only about 10% finish. Now, that's still a pretty big number, but even then, we're talking about the limitations of what did they learn? How do they know it? How deeply do they know it? How do I test 30,000 people on knowing a topic beyond a simple multiple choice exam? And so we're seeing in higher education this happening as well. We're seeing something called the flipped classroom. What we used to do is we used to bring everyone on campus together, and 300 of us would sit in a room, and I would talk at you, and then for after 2 hours, I'd send you home to read. Or I'd send you to a discussion group to talk about it with 10 of your 20 of your friends. We're realizing that's exactly the opposite of how we should be doing it. They can listen to the lecture in their pajamas at home. Let them. Then we bring them into the classroom, not so they can sit and listen, but so they can work together. We can take articles and say, what did you think of that reading? Let's have that discussion. Let's build this. Let's work on this laboratory assignment. Let's do something authentic. And so what we're seeing in higher education is that the lecture halls are becoming performance spaces where people come in to learn and talk. The lecture's happening offline. We see it in not only when we look at higher education as a teaching environment, but in a research environment. In open access, that document I talked before, when I'm doing a physics study, not only am I sort of working and toiling in my lab, waiting for the results, waiting for the publication, but as the results are coming, I'm posting it on a blog, I'm posting it out in the world. I'm posting my book so that anyone can read it and anyone can edit and add to it. With altmetrics, which is instead of looking at just at how many people cited a paper, I'm looking at how many people participated, how many people looked at that data, implemented that data. Not only did they read my article, but they actually downloaded the data and ran their own analysis on it. And this is a large part, a shift in the locus of innovation. What that means is where you used to go to college to learn the cutting edge in fields like computing, technology, information, in library science, these days that innovation is occurring out in the field where it always happened, but now it's being documented and it's available. So now when something brilliant happens in India or something brilliant happens in Mumbai, they can put that online and I can read about it instantaneously. Why do I need to go to a college to read about it? Well, the reason you go to a college is now to make sense of it. So I work in an information school, right? So we teach technology and technology usage. And one of the constant discussions is, well, kids these days, at least in America, they know how all this technology works. They show up and they know more about the technology than the professors. And what we found is that's not quite true. They know how to use technology probably better than the professors. They can text faster. They can know what the new app is. They can put the app on it. But they don't necessarily understand the implications and how it works. In one classroom, someone asked the question, you know, how long have you been on the internet today? Right? How many hours have you spent on the internet? Students would raise their hand. Well, you know, 15 minutes. Oh, I did searching in Facebook, whatever. It takes me an hour, 2 hours, right? They get really, I'm addicted. I've been on there for 5 hours. And then the professor asks, how many of you have cell phones? And everyone in the classroom raises their hand. He goes, you've been on the internet 24 hours today. And what you don't necessarily understand is while you weren't actively using and consuming, other people were. They were looking at your metadata. They were looking at your usage. They were looking at where you were. They were looking at all this information. Do you understand the implications of that? So the locus of innovation is that schools aren't necessarily building the cell phones, but they're making sense of it and they're trying to bring in the analysis. They're trying to get people to think critically about it. And because of that, we're realizing that students need to be part of that discussion and shaping that discussion and not simply empty buckets that we're throwing bricks of knowledge into. So what we're really seeing is a shift in a model in higher education, in medicine, and in librarianship, where this idea that for so long we have led with our backs turned to the people that we serve. That in essence what we do is we turn around and we point out to the distance and say, look over there, look over there, look over there. And to serve them, we ignore them briefly while we show them what we have. We build collections of external resources, and that makes sense because we think about the idea that we bring all this stuff to our community so they can learn, ignoring that the communities may know a lot. One of the things that drives me absolutely nuts, quite honestly, is that if I'm going to a town in the United States and I look at their public library, I can find out everything about where I am and nothing about where that library is. I'm amazed when I see images of public libraries in sub-Saharan Africa where they look exactly like a library in rural New York. They have the Dewey Decimal System, they have the reference desk, they have the stacks. For so long, what we've done is we've worried in libraries about standardization, that if somehow we all choose the exact same model of how we look, how we work, how we structure, how we build our facilities, we'll gain some economy of scale. I blame Melville Dewey's addiction to efficiency on that. And it's crazy. Why is it that Central New York libraries should look like sub-Saharan Namibia libraries? Shouldn't they look like their communities? Shouldn't they be shaped around what their communities are interested in, how they learn? Get back to that in a second. For so long, we viewed people as simply users or customers. I actually like the word patrons because at least it indicates that there's some investment. I hate the term users. And that's what we talk about, our users of our databases, our users of our services. Do you really want to be known as someone who uses someone else? Isn't that kind of abusive? Right? And that's what user implies, is that someone comes in, they use you, and they leave. That's not what we want. And I hate the word customers even more. Because what it implies is that there's an us and them mentality. That we have our collections and our materials and our information and our expertise, and they come in and consume it. As if they have nothing to contribute. As if they can't teach us what's going on. As if we can't use what they're doing. As if we're limited simply to what our employment staff shows and our buildings represent. We need to get away from this idea. We've seen this, for example, in outreach to underserved communities, both here and abroad. We look at the idea of, in the U.S., we look at underserved populations, Latino populations, poor populations, African-American, inner-city populations, and we bring them books, and we bring them databases, and we say, here's how to find a job, and here's how to get a degree, and here's how to get an education. And what we end up doing is bringing them literature. We bring them written materials, and we bring that to a culture that is primarily an oral culture, where they have learned by asking their friends and asking their mentors and asking their elders. And so what we're doing is we're asking them not simply to consume in a different way, we're asking them to learn in a different way. This was put to me beautifully when we were talking about public libraries, and I was in Italy, and one of the Italian libraries said, the difference between the U.S. public library and the Italian public library is in Italy, when someone wants to learn to make sauce, they ask their mother. Right? They don't go check out a cookbook. They don't go out check out five cookbooks. They don't go online for a recipe. They ask their mother. It's an oral tradition. And yet, what we bring is this structured Dewey Decimal literature-based, text-based, dense text search engines, and we drop it into an oral culture and say, learn from this. What can we learn from an oral culture? What can we learn by talking and tapping into those elders? What can we learn by listening, by translating, by working with how they learn? And now this might sound crazy because ultimately you're saying, all right, Dave, but I'm a library. Of course I'm about books and materials. Let's spend a little bit of time defining for a minute what a library is. Because to me it's not a building, and it's not a collection, and it's not a stuff. It's something built by a librarian. It's something built based on the mission of a librarian. And what is that mission? The mission of librarians is to improve society. Feel free to stop there. Right? We're a social good. We do good. We try and improve the world that we're in. That's what makes us a noble profession. And how do we seek to improve society? Because we don't necessarily do it through experimental dance. We don't necessarily do it by creating videos and movies and entertainment. How do we do it? We do it by facilitating knowledge creation within our communities. Right? So I don't think that sounds too radical, right? But we're in the knowledge business. I think we've always felt like we're in the knowledge business. This is good. But let's break this down for a minute, and let's look at this mission. Because the mission says more than simply keep doing what you're doing. We have to define these terms. So, for example, why is this a mission of librarians and not institutions? Because institutions have missions as well. You guys are talking about how do I serve an embassy staff or the local community or how do I serve the larger Department of State, etc. And that puts confinements on your budget and what you do. But as a librarian, you can have your own mission that's above and separated, that joins you to other librarians both within your system and outside of your system. People make the difference. A room full of books is a closet. An empty room with a librarian, it is a library. Will they build a collection and eventually put stuff in it? If they have an internet connection, will they build a website and a Pathfinder? Yes, they probably will. But it's the librarian and that active human curation of their community that makes a librarian what they do. And what do we mean about knowledge creation? Well, we have to understand a little bit about knowledge, because we treat knowledge as if it's a thing, as if it's something that we can shelve, as if it's something we can put between pages. But we know that that's not true, that knowledge is created through conversation. It's a uniquely human process that we learn by having conversations. Conversations with others, conversations with experts, conversations with those elders and communities, but a lot of times conversations with ourselves. When we're reading a book, we're engaged in a conversation, but it's not with the book. It's a dead tree. And it's not with the author. they may well be dead as well. It's with ourselves. When we read a passage and it resonates with us, do we remember it? Do we incorporate it? Do we learn? Do we challenge it? Do we say that's right or not? How many times have you gone back and read your favorite books after like 10 years? And the part that you said, oh, this is the most amazing part of the book, and it's like two lines. And you're going, I thought that was a much bigger part of the book. It was for you and your conversation that made a bigger impact. That's what knowledge is about. And so when we talk about facilitating knowledge creation, what we're doing is facilitating conversations. A lot of those internal conversations by providing right resources and materials, but oftentimes by connecting two people or two organizations together. We facilitate conversations between the embassy staff and the regions that we serve. That's the role of a librarian. You say, well, that's the role of a diplomat. There's not a heck of a lot of difference between a librarian and a diplomat sometimes, right? And what do I mean by facilitating? What does that word mean? Well, think about for a moment, how do we facilitate? The number one way, and the way that we've thought about for hundreds and hundreds of years, is through access. We provide access. Access to stuff, access to books, access to reports, access to materials, access to databases. We do it through our licensing. We do it through our organization, through our cataloging, through our shelving, through our spaces. We provide access. Yes. But do you also provide access to the conversations, to the people, to the authors and not simply the books, to the other readers, to other people who are interested, to the idea of connecting people across disparate communities, time and space, and bringing them together? Access is not simply to stuff. Access is to learning, to conversations, to environments, to experiences. We do it by providing training and knowledge, which is, yes, I can get you into this database or this online discussions of physics, but if you don't understand this language or if you don't understand these cultural norms, then you're not going to be prepared. So I need to give you computer skills, language skills, technology skills, diplomacy skills, whatever skills. We do it by providing a safe environment. Physical safe environment that people can come in and feel safe in learning, but also intellectually safe environment. When we talk about intellectual safety, when we talk about intellectual freedom, the ability to explore any document on any topic without having someone looking over your shoulder, that is a safety concern. How do we provide an environment that people can come in and ask the stupid question? Search out materials that may not be culturally acceptable. To look and go beyond simply what is the mainstream understanding of things. That's providing a safe environment. And we do it by providing motivation. Motivation, not only intrinsic motivation that we thrive off of, that is when someone is motivated for their own rewards to come and ask and learn, but we provide extrinsic motivation. We provide, you know, rewards, badges. We provide certification. We provide information. We provide a necessary function. You have to get this training through the library, what have you. And finally, back to that improving society, which is an ethical counterbalance to the second part. That is, yes, we provide access and a safe environment to all of this, but not necessarily to things that we feel are destructive, that we ultimately have to do what's right for the community, even if the community doesn't believe it. We see here under ethical counterbalance, we see the idea of what we bring to this mission. We bring to it a series of values. What set librarians apart is not only what they do and why they do it, but the values they bring within it. We bring this value of learning, that when people come in, we want to facilitate learning in whatever form and mode works best. We bring openness, that is openness to the community, to the conversation, to the topics, and to the process, that when we provide you information, we let you know how we came about it. We provide this intellectual freedom and safety, and we do it in an intellectually honest way. For too long, librarians have talked about being unbiased, this idea that somehow we can remove ourselves from the process of providing information. You cannot. The color of your skin, where you were raised, the language that you speak, the culture or raising that you came from, all of this influences what you do. When you're asked a question and your first impulse is to start typing or to reach for a book, you're showing a bias. When you provide literature and printed materials when they want an oral explanation, you're showing a bias. I had an example, back to that medical example. I had a doctoral student that was studying how people answered reference questions in a medical environment. Virtual reference questions. So once again, they were receiving them by email or chat. And it turns out that when medical librarians in this particular medical library would receive a question, the first thing they would do is not research the answer to the question. They would find out who asked the question. Was it a doctor? Was it a nurse? Was it a community member? Was it an administrator? And they would shape the answers based upon their understanding of that person. So, for example, they would say, if a nurse asks me a question, I will provide the information back to them in paper. I'll send them paper documents because nurses aren't that technologically literate. They don't have good access to technology. This was a couple of years ago, and they really need the paper. The doctoral student then interviewed nurses, and nurses were like, oh, they provide great information, but they're always giving me all this paper. I really need it electronically. What happens is the librarians had a bias. It wasn't in how they answered the questions or the resources they provided. It was in a medium bias, but it was a bias. We have them. Accept it. But what we can be and what we should be as librarians is intellectually honest. That is, we acknowledge our biases and we try our best to work against them. We try our best to account for them. We try our best to represent them to the people who answer it. We are intellectually honest about where we came from. And we hopefully are open to learning about how to do things better. So now let's look at how some of these services, how some of these ideas of sort of reconceptualizing librarianship around knowledge as a human function created through conversation and facilitation, how might that look beyond simply here's a place with a bunch of licensed databases, come get us? This is one of my favorites. It's called the Human Library. And the Human Library allows you to check out a prejudice. What they do is, and I love it because they call people books, right? And so they have a fireman, someone who's gay, someone who's a Muslim, someone who's black, someone who's handicapped. All of these people who have some sort of unique expertise, they become the books, and you can check them out. And you could talk to someone in a really open, honest way about what is it like in this case to be handicapped? What is it like? I thought this, the Muslims believe this. I thought Jews believe this. I thought Christians believe this. And they do it in a library environment because it provides a safe environment. In other words, it's a place they can come and you can assure both the book and the reader. You can assure both sides that this is going to be a safe and neutral, or at least open, environment to have that conversation in, that it's all right to have these conversations. And so what we see is access, like traditional access, but in this case it's access to conversations, it's access to what's in people's heads, it's access to people. It's still a core library function. It's just not around documents and representations of resources. It's about actual knowledge and conversations. And it shows us using our environment, both physical and intellectual safety. We're doing this in a place where you can't do it elsewhere, where you can feel comfortable, where you are protected in having this conversation, where no one will judge you for having this conversation. Another example, this is the community garden at the North Onondaga Public Library. That's Meg Bacchus and her husband who started it up. And it started because Meg was an adult services librarian. A bunch of adults would come in and they would say, these are the kinds of things we want, these are the kind of programs, and Meg would make it happen. And Meg is absolutely brilliant. Meg is just a brilliant individual. So when someone started asking her about gardening, a couple of people, you know, she could have said, oh, I'll get a master gardener to come do a lecture. Oh, I'll go buy some books on gardening. What she said is, you know, we got all this land around us, and I got a hose. Let's build a garden. If you want to learn about building a garden and gardening and agriculture, the best way is to actually go in and kill the plant and overfeed this and overwater that and figure out if the insects eat this to do it. And so she was providing that knowledge and training, but not in the form of resources and webinars, but by learning by doing. We'll come back to that in a second. In essence, the librarian's mission of facilitating knowledge creation, that knowledge creation was active, participatory, haptic, happening. And she was building on the motivation of the community where they wanted to know something. And what's interesting is she then used it to expand that to further. So in September, what happens in the United States is you plant tomato plants at the beginning of the summer, and in September you get 5 billion tomatoes. And you have no idea. You cannot eat this many tomatoes. And so what they started learning about was local food sourcing. They learned about food pantry. They learned about where food can go within the community to make a help. And so they expanded how they learned and what they learned and went to whole new ways that wouldn't simply happen by, here's a book on gardening. I know later you're going to talk about makerspaces. This is Lauren Britton. She started the first makerspace at a public library here in the United States at Fayetteville Free Library. I'm thrilled to say she's now currently at one of my doctoral students at Syracuse University. And she built a makerspace. And you're going to learn about makerspaces. And what she's holding in her hand is the beginnings of a 3D printer. And the first thing I'll tell you about a makerspace is that it's more than 3D printing. The idea of a makerspace is that it's a place that people can come in a safe environment, and they can learn that they don't simply have to buy things, they can actually make them. They can make them through 3D printing, they can make them through electronics, they can make them through physical tools, they can make them through having a wood lathe, they can make them. The idea is to teach people how to build things on their own. And what she provided through the space was access to expertise. But what's interesting is that expertise wasn't the librarian. A lot of the concerns around makerspaces in the library community is, oh God, I have a 3D printer. Do I need to know everything about 3D printing and 3D printing languages and 3D modeling? And how do I going to know all this? But that wasn't the point. The point was to bring in people who already knew it and bring them in as a community. Back to the idea, the doctor may know all the medicine, but I know how I work on a day-to-day life, put them together. This came very, very clear to Lauren and myself at an event where the Makerspace had this event, and they called it BristleBots. And what a BristleBot is you take a toothbrush, and you cut off the bristles at the front, you attach an old vibrating battery from pager. In other words, when the pager used to go zzz, what it is a little motor that spins something that makes it vibrate. And you put a watch battery on that to run it, and then what happens is the BristleBot will zzz, vibrate along the table. And then what you can do is race them and put them through mazes and all this other stuff. And so the librarians were there cutting and clipping and walking my son, who was at the time 7, through this and walking other people through it. And then what they found out is they bought the wrong watch batteries. So they didn't have much power, so what happens is they would connect it to the BristleBot, and the BristleBot would go bzzz in about 10 seconds. And all the librarians, there were 3 of them, gathered into a room, and they're trying to figure out, what do we do about this? And we're out of batteries. And, oh, do I run out and get batteries? Do we have the budget for that? I don't know what to do with them. And while the librarians are over in the corner trying to figure out what to happen, the kids looked at it and said, anyone got any AA batteries and triple batteries and other batteries? And pretty soon what they're doing is they're duct taping whole toothbrushes together and putting on AA batteries and making bristle tanks and bristle, you know, attack bots and bristle aircraft carriers. And what the librarians suddenly realized, and I suddenly realized looking at them, was the kids were developing and learning about bristle bots and technology and making on their own. That the librarians were actually in the way before it. That what they learned is that knowledge by doing is much more powerful and much more valuable than simply knowledge by tutorial. And that the people that they needed to staff the makerspace with weren't librarians, they were carpenters, they were machinists, they were computer programmers. They Chattanooga, Tennessee, they have brilliant, brilliant librarians, and they had code days for all these teenagers to come in, and they would learn HTML coding and JavaScript coding. They brought in programmers, and you say, well, why at the library? Because the library provided the safe space to happen. The library provided the knowledge to happen. They connected the kids who wanted to learn with the coders, and then they were there that as the kids wanted to go more, yes, they could provide books and materials, but they could also access to new community members and online tutorials. It was a brilliant sort of explosion of learning. What we've seen in libraries is an evolution of the tools of knowledge. We've seen over thousands of years of libraries, a progressive refinement and improvement to our tools to meet our mission. We've gone from scrolls to books and materials to online databases and resources. Right? We've improved access to ideas, but now we have the ability to add actual knowledge. Not because it's trendy or cool, and not to displace traditional information resources, rather to facilitate the core of what our communities need, a better tomorrow through knowledge development. Because this is and has always been our true collection. The ideas and dreams and expertise of our communities. We can now connect the brilliance of the local to the global. Not simply bring the world to our communities, but bringing our communities to the world. We can unleash the ideas, the expertise, the experience, the perspectives of these local communities and make them available to the rest of the world. Where for so long we have looked at libraries as places that collect artifacts, We now can return to our true mission as places where people dream and create new knowledge and new ideas and improve their society. The Library of Alexandria that many of us trace back to the origin of libraries was built not as a storehouse of scrolls, but as an economic development think tank. It was more university than library as we think about them today, as book repository. The librarian was one of the main counselors to the kings of Alexandria. They would bring scholars from around the world, and they would have them interact and talk and think and brilliant. And when they came up with a brilliant idea, they would write them on scrolls. And they would take the scrolls and they would put them into the building dedicated to the muses, to the god of intellectual development, the musée, which is where we get the term museum. The library was a place for the scholars. Is your library a place for new ideas to be born, or simply for the documents of the world to be stored? That's important that we provide access to databases, materials, and other people's ideas, but we do it in service of a larger goal, which is not access, but creation. Libraries are not about storing other people's ideas. They are the birthplace of our community's goals, aspirations, and dreams. That's why we talk about maker spaces and getting out of our buildings. That's why we talk about places of creation. That's why we talk about community gardens. Not because they're trendy, but because they fulfill the fundamental mission of a librarian, which is to help people learn and know. Yes, we can do that through databases and books, and yes, we can do that by sending email back and forth. But ultimately, we do that by engaging our communities in conversation. What do you want to be tomorrow? Let me help you do it. We do it, and we do it through knowledge. We do it through learning. We do it through a specific fundamental means of facilitations, and we do it with our values. But that's not restricted to our tools. They will change, and they will constantly change. And the importance of librarians come not by our knowledge of metadata, not by our knowledge of cataloging. They come not by our ability to shelve. The value of a librarian comes in the ability of a young boy to learn, of a young girl to dream, of a community to build. That's what makes a library powerful. That's why we're within our communities. That's why we must go out to our communities. That's why we are librarians as a noble profession. I thank you for your time. I look for any feedback. I'll give you my email address, blogs, what have you. I'll make sure that this screencast is on my website so you can look at it again and tear it apart if you'd like. Thank you, and I wish you good luck in your day, and I wish you good luck in your mission.